Now look, the point of those teasers is that to get us to see, first of all, that we don't always see what's right under our noses, do we? We don't always see what's right under our noses. We're conditioned to notice certain things and to ignore or filter out things that we don't expect to see. And that's going to help us, I hope, as we think about this big question this lunchtime, is God there? I'm guessing that we probably come from a range of different positions on the question, is God there? Some of us will be convinced that there is a God, but maybe others among us are hoping that there's a God. Maybe particularly we've suffered some sort of loss and we're looking for hope. Still others among us, maybe, there might be some who are hoping there isn't a God, who are pretty sure that there isn't a God. The major divide in the world isn't actually between atheists and religious people, as we sometimes think. Actually, the major divide is between those people who say God is unknown and those who say they know God. The major divide is between those who say God is unknown and those who would say that they know God. The agnostic person may or may not be very religious, but ultimately they say they don't really know God. Just pick up, will you, the sheet you were given at the door on the way in, which has printed on the back there the words of a speech that was given in Athens in the first century. Now today Athens is famous for other things, but at the time Athens was the intellectual capital of the whole world. And the speech is by the Apostle Paul, who is one of the people commissioned by Jesus Christ to take his message out to more people after his own death. And it's recorded in the book of Acts in the New Testament part of the Bible. Let's just look down at the first paragraph. It says, Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus, that's the council of philosophers there in Athens, and said, people of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. So you are ignorant of the very thing you worship, and this is what I'm going to proclaim to you. The word that's translated there, unknown and ignorant, it both translates the same root Greek word, which is agnosto, where we get the words agnostic and ignorant from, agnosto. So you see, the people in Athens weren't atheists, they were very religious. But do you see that they were religious agnostics? They didn't know the gods that they were worshipping. The altars and idols that they filled their city with, and their many religious rituals, were fueled by a sense that they didn't really know God. But Paul says, what you worship as something unknown, I am going to proclaim to you. He is going to make the unknown God known. We don't need to be agnostic, in other words. Like with these brain teasers we were looking at the start, the evidence that there is a God is actually there before our eyes. All that we need is to have that pointed out. And that's what Paul does in what follows there. Let's read on. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by human hands. And he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. From one man he made all the nations that they should inhabit the whole earth. And he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. As some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. The agnosticism of the people there in Athens wasn't because God hadn't made himself known. It was because they hadn't appreciated what they were seeing all around them. It's the same for us today. We might thrash through our religious rituals or bury our heads in the sand about God, but the signposts to a good God are actually all around us. The whole world and our own very existence shows that there must be a God. scientists are doing all they can to explain how the world came about. But even if you keep chasing the origins of the world back and back and back, you still end up needing a creator who is outside of and before our material universe. Even if we can trace the origins of the universe back to a Big Bang, well, you still need a big match to ignite the Big Bang, don't you? And you need matter to come from somewhere. Nothing comes from nothing. And actually, we don't need to keep pushing the question of origins back and back in order to realise there's a God. It should be obvious from the way the world is now in our experience that it must have been crafted by a good, wise and powerful maker. Let me try to illustrate that with just one small feature of our world. Our third child was born just before Christmas, and I've been marvelling at the whole process of new life in a baby. Soon after our first child was born, a complete stranger said to us, we were at a wedding actually, and a complete stranger came up to us, looked at the baby and said, "Aren't you clever?" And I couldn't help myself but answer, "Well, no, not really. It's God who's clever. Our role in making the baby didn't really require much cleverness at all." But babies show obvious signs that there is a good designer behind the natural world. Just think about it. I wonder if you know some of these things about how babies are born and how they form. Do you know that a baby's head is soft and small in order to allow it to be born, and then it expands and hardens afterwards? Did you know that as a newborn baby starts suckling its mother for the first time, that immediately releases hormones which cause the placenta to come away inside her body? Isn't that amazing? Despite the best efforts of Nestle and the rest, we haven't been able to invent anything better than breast milk to feed our children with. It's an amazing way of passing on immunity to colds and infections, for example. And have you noticed how babies' mouths are designed for breastfeeding? And how when they get to an age where they start to need proper food, their mouths actually change shape to give them a bite, and their teeth drop down into place just when they're needed. Isn't that amazing? My wife keeps telling me that our baby's hunger levels control her own appetite, so that if he's going on a growth spurt, his body somehow communicates that to her, and so she finds herself craving meat or chocolate or whatever. So she tells me anyway. Now look, when Apple designs machines with a fraction of the beauty and complexity of a baby, we don't say it's the product of random mutations, do we? We call Steve Jobs and his successors geniuses. If you've got children of your own, just go home and take a good look at them tonight, maybe while they're sleeping especially, and just marvel at their beauty and their complexity. I think those things show us that they were designed rather than being an accident. The world around us demonstrates that there must be a God. And not just any God, but a good, loving, wise and powerful God. That's the obvious conclusion that we would draw if we look at the world around us carefully. Even Charles Darwin admitted that. Do you know that? Darwin wrote, "To suppose that the eye could have been formed by natural selection, I freely confess, is absurd in the highest degree." When we try to explain the world without reference to God, actually we end up with more and more far-fetched theories. Atheistic scientists are now having to suggest that there must be an infinite number of parallel universes in order to explain how our universe could have ended up as it is. Now, I'm no expert, but that sounds to me like a desperate attempt to try to explain away the fact that our world shows every sign of being ordered by a divine designer. And it's not just atheists who say that God is unknown, is it? Remember that the people in Athens were very religious, but they didn't know God. They had some sense that there was a God or gods, but in their ignorance or agnosticism about that God, well, they tried every religious means they could to try and get to know and to please that God. And we're often the same today, aren't we? I wonder how many of us have some sense that there's a God, but we don't feel we really know him. And so we might try to do our best to worship him however seems right to us, but actually we're not really sure whether we're doing the right thing or whether the rituals of some other religion might be better. Or maybe we try to combine the rituals of various religions and superstitions. We comfort ourselves that we're doing a bit of religion just in case there's a God. But that sort of unknowing religion is futile at best, and at worst it's presumptuous. You see, agnostic religion is based on trying to make the unknown God known through our own activity, like building temples and following rituals. But notice again how daft that is. Second line of that second paragraph, it says, God is not served by human hands as if he needed anything. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. You see, everything we might try to use to make God known in the world was already made by him in the first place. Our hands, our very breath itself, are a gift from God. Neither atheism nor religious agnosticism are what God wants. Now, the problem with our agnosticism, our ignorance about God, is not that God hasn't made himself known. He has. The problem is that we've closed our eyes and our minds to what he's revealed. Like with those brain teasers, we've allowed ourselves to be conditioned to perceive reality in a way that screens out what's there in front of our eyes, what we don't expect to see or what we don't want to see. Something deep inside us that doesn't want there to be a God, because we think it means that I'm not ultimately boss of my own life. We imagine that a life with God is less satisfying than a life in which I'm boss of my own world. And so we close our eyes and close our minds to the signposts that are all around us. We might think that agnosticism is humble, but do you see that if God has made himself known, then it's actually very arrogant of us to disregard him. The humble thing would be to acknowledge and accept the God who has made himself known. And so I want to suggest a little thought experiment for us. Over the next few days, will you look carefully at the world around you? Will you try looking at the world a little bit differently? Maybe you remember the 1980s and 90s quiz show Catchphrase. Can anyone remember Catchphrase? The idea was they'd show a picture of a well-known phrase, and you have to work out what phrase it is meant to represent. And do you remember what the host of the show used to say? He said, "Say what you see. Say what you see." So I want us to do that thought experiment over the next few days. Look at the world around you and say what you see. You see, the world shows signs of a good and able designer. Will you notice the beauty in the natural world? Will you notice the beauty and complexity in the way that our bodies are made, in the ways that we relate to one another? Will you ask yourself whether that's most likely to be the product of random mutations, a random coincidence of atoms, which could have ended up totally different in a parallel universe? Or does it show that there's a wise and good and powerful creator behind it? Will you do that thought experiment? Will you be willing to consider that explanations of the world without a God are not enough? I'd love you to do that, not only because we thrash around in agnostic darkness when we don't need to, but also, more importantly, because it matters to God whether we know him or not. It matters to God. Just look at the third paragraph of the speech there on the sheet, and notice the moral imperative in what Paul says there. He says, Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by human design and skill. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, for he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead. all I've said today has been to try to show that there is a God who we don't need to be agnostic about, a God that we can know. You might be asking yourself, well, that's all very well, but how do I know that it's the Christian God? And the answer is because the Christian God came to earth as a man, the man Jesus Christ, and he rose from the dead. The two great pieces of evidence for the Christian God are the world around us, and secondly, the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, bodily, seen by many witnesses, believed by thousands, even in the first generation, when it could so easily have been disproved if it wasn't true. Paul believes that the resurrection is such firm evidence that he even calls it proof. I'm not going to go into the evidence for the resurrection further this lunchtime, but I have brought along some of these little booklets which are called The Evidence for the Resurrection. And do ask me afterwards if that's something of particular interest to you, and I'm happy to give you one of these leaflets to take away. But why does it matter? Why can't we just carry on in agnostic apathy? Well, because the risen Lord Jesus is going to return at a fixed date in the future to judge us for our response to him. That's the claim of the Bible. No doubt that sounds harsh or unfair. We hate the idea of judgment, and yet that's what's promised to us. And rather than carry on now, can I ask you to come back and hear more next Wednesday lunchtime, when I'm going to be giving the second of these two talks, Is God Fair? Really, all I've had time to do today is just give you an extended appetite whetter to come and hear the Christian message more fully explained and defended next week. So please will you come back, same time, same place, next week to hear more. For now, though, you'll see at the end of our passage that when Paul originally gave his speech, there were three responses that he experienced. I wonder whether we'll experience the same today. When they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered, first of all. Now, that's the last resort of people that have no answer to what's been said. Secondly, though, others said, we want to hear you again on this subject. I hope you'll come back and hear more. If this is the first time you've heard about Christian things, do come back, please. At that, Paul left the council. Thirdly, though, some of the people became followers of Paul and believed. Among them was Dionysius, a member of the Areopagus, also a woman named Damaris, and a number of others. The reason we've gone to the trouble of putting on this talk this lunchtime is not just because it's a pleasant way to spend a lunchtime, although I hope it is, but because we're convinced that we need to believe the evidence about the God of the Bible. So please, don't let your discussions about the things that we've been hearing this lunchtime remain purely academic or intellectual. Don't allow yourself to sink again into the fog of agnosticism or apathy. But will you be willing to believe that there is a good, wise, powerful God who made this world and who longs for you to know him? Let me deal with those that I've got here then. First question, there's a lot of evidence for good in the world, but how about bad things? I think that's one of the sort of obvious questions from what I've had to say. So I've argued that we can see the beauty of the world around us and the complexity, but what about evil? What about when the world is a pretty ugly place in some ways? And I think the answer to that is that if you read right back at the beginning of the Bible, the early chapters of the Bible, we're told in the book of Genesis that the world was made good, and yet mankind has turned against God. We've wanted to be masters of our own world, and with that, we've brought in all sorts of brokenness in this world. Broken relationships, as people are jealous of one another and fight against one another, both on an individual level and national level and within companies. I'm sure you know that. But we see the brokenness of the world in other ways, that God has actually allowed some of the consequences of our rebellion against him to be seen in the natural world, in natural disasters, in sickness and disease. It doesn't necessarily mean when someone suffers sickness that they're any worse sinner than anyone else. but they're all indications of the brokenness of the world. And I think as we look at the world around us, we can see that the world is broken as well as beautiful. And the Christian, the Bible explains that, both the beauty and the brokenness of the world, in a way that I'm not sure that the other big worldviews do. I'm not sure that there are satisfactory other explanations than the answers the Bible gives, that God made the world beautiful, and we can still see that. But he also allowed us to break it, and he shows us the signs of its brokenness. And he also promises a day when the world will be remade even more beautiful than it was to start with. So when we ask, you know, the classic question that I'm often asked, how can God allow the evil in the world, the brokenness in the world? Why doesn't he do something about it? Well, actually, as Christians, we do have hope, a sure expectation that a day is coming when God will remake the world and will purge all evil from the world. But we need to make sure that by the time that happens, we're in the right with God, because we do have that hope of a day when it will all be made better. The atheist, of course, doesn't have that hope. There's no grounds for hope. And that's why genuine through and through atheists have often ended up in despair, and have ended up in madness or in suicide, because actually there is no hope, if there's no God, of this world being a better place. That's a very condensed answer. Do talk to me afterwards if that sparked further questions. Next question. What are your views on the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail and the Da Vinci Code, which claim that the accession, should that say ascension, is purely metaphorical? Ascension is purely metaphorical. Yeah, thank you very much. Blockbuster books, both of them. I've read them both. I read the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail as a student. While I was looking into Christian things, actually, before I was persuaded myself, I thought I ought to read some of the sort of non-Christian arguments as well as reading some Christians. And yeah, they sold lots of copies, didn't they? And the Da Vinci Code even more. But actually, when we look at the Bible for ourselves, and I would say to anyone who's been influenced by one of these books or any of the other sort of conspiracy theories that are out there, you know, the big paperbacks that sell lots of copies, I would say read it, but read the Bible as well. Read Luke's Gospel in the New Testament in particular. The Gospel of Luke starts out, let me just read the first few verses. They're famous verses, maybe you've heard them before, but I think they're worth reading and rereading. It says, many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. Therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seems good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you've been taught. That's the beginning of Luke's Gospel, his account of Jesus' life and death, resurrection and ascension. The same person wrote the book of Acts, which is where the speech that we've been looking at today comes from. And all the way through, it's littered with historical information, background and so on. It doesn't read like metaphor. We're not meant to take it as metaphor. And in fact, many of the first generation of those who believed these things themselves died for what they were claiming. This isn't simply a guideline for life. These are historical truth claims, things that either happened or didn't happen among the generation who made the claims, and they died for those claims. So it's hard to see how they could have been deluded about the nature of those claims, and it's hard to see how those around them at the time that they were making those claims and that they were giving their lives for those claims, it's hard to see how those who weren't convinced, who didn't become Christians, how they couldn't have disproved Christianity right at the beginning. You know, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, how come no one came forward and said, okay, I admit it, I stole the body, here are the bones, or whatever explanation it might be. It's astonishing that just 7 weeks or so after the resurrection, the Apostle Peter was able to stand up in Jerusalem, the place where Jesus was crucified, and say to the assembly of the Jewish leaders, the people who were responsible for handing Jesus over to be crucified, and say to them, this man rose from the dead. And no one, it seems, spoke up and said, no, he didn't rise from the dead. Here's the evidence. So I find it very striking. Dan Brown has made a lot of money out of his book, but I don't find it persuasive, I'm afraid. Again, talk to me afterwards if you want to take that up further. The last question I've had handed in, why do we need a church? I don't know what motivated the question. I wonder whether it's because because Paul in his speech talked about how we don't need religious rituals and temples and that sort of thing, which is absolutely right. Church is first and foremost a gathering of Christian people to enjoy being God's people together and to encourage one another in the truth that the Bible teaches, to believe it and to apply it in every aspect of our lives. The Bible talks about church as a family. Church isn't first and foremost a building. It isn't first and foremost about rituals or institutions or religious leaders in gowns and fancy hats and everything else. It's first and foremost a family of people who share the conviction that Jesus Christ rose from the dead and that he is the Lord and Saviour of the whole world. And a family who gather together week by week to encourage one another in believing those things and applying those truths to their lives. So that's why we need church. We become a new fellowship, a new community, a renewed humanity, really, when we know God, when we accept the claims of the Bible.